Tonight we're rounding out the series of about time, and some of you are glad to see it go. Some of you didn't make any sense to you whatsoever and saw nothing practical in it from your comments to me. Other people get a great deal, but I appreciate more than anything your patience. And even if it didn't deeply touch you, still your willingness to look at the subject, to explore the subject, to examine it, and perhaps the next time it arises, there's a renewed interest in perceiving it for what it is and perhaps going a little deeper into the subject. Because I can tell you that it touches the topic of time, touches the entire extent of our life here on earth. Nothing is untouched by time. How we see, what we see, who we hold ourselves to be, how we conceive of our life, what we hold as meaningful and purposeful, everything has everything to do with this subject. So it's not a small subject. It holds really vast resources of the Dharma within it, if not all of the Dharma. And that's one of the reasons that the next series I'm going to be talking about death, because I want to put an ending of time. All of a sudden we can glide along endlessly in our safe vehicle of youth, and then never consider the ending of when this is all going to end, and thereby never really consider seriously the nature of time. The nature of time. And when we do consider it, we consider it more in terms of something that's a given, a fact of life. And what am I going to do within it now that I know that it's going to end? As if it were a vehicle that we're riding and that we just have to acknowledge it somehow and as a precious resource, and then do something within it that may be a little more appropriate or aligned with our intention than just be frivolous within it. But that's not what I'm suggesting here in these series. I'm suggesting something much more critical in our relationship to time, and that is it real at all? You see? Not whether we're going to just play in it once we take it seriously. And I hope everybody takes their time, their life seriously. I mean, that's really step one of any Dharma adventure, is that you come to a critical evaluation of what you're doing and why you're doing it within time. But this goes below that level. This is a question of the reality of time. Is it a fact or is it self-generated, self-created? And I like to ask that question, because until we do, nothing really changes. Yes, we can get very serious when we change our relationship to time, and we can take it rather poignantly and deliberately, but that's just a kind of modification on the boat of our traveling through our life. I'm looking, and I hope you're willing to as well, the issue of whether it is even true. You see, I don't want to just take the wine glass and savor the taste that's in it. I want to take the wine glass, look at it, and throw it against the mantle. That's probably the reason that there isn't a great deal of delight about this subject. Because as we throw that wine glass, our entire life is precariously perched within it. And it really does ask us to deliberate upon the reality of our own existence, really, when we look at time. Because the more we validate our thoughts, the more we are trapped within time. And most of us validate our thoughts endlessly. So let us not superficially say, oh, I know, we've gone through now four talks, I know that it's not, I know it's self-created, I know it's not a reality and truth. So let's move on. Well, are we ready to move on? Are we continuing to validate ourselves even as we sit here through our thinking? Because if we're using that vehicle of thought for the sense of self-validation, then we are still riding and resting within the composite and component of time. That's all. So if we take time as a fact, as a given, then we have to question that fact. Let us at least question it. There are two ways, and I'm going to go through each of these ways tonight, to address a reality. One is to really look, to undermine the reality itself by looking at it and questioning, having questions about the nature of reality, which we will do with time and have done with time. The other is to explore the pain that this particular fact offers when we accept it as a reality. And then the pain wakes us up to go back to step one and question whether there is another way that we are not understanding in this moment rather than what we're taking reality to be. So what you see, that, and we have already spoken a great deal about this first question, about whether time, what is time? Questioning the fact of time, what is it really? What is it really when we look at it? We have to be very serious about it. We can't suppose anything. We can't take anything for granted. We have to look and be very quiet in ourselves. As soon as we are very quiet in ourselves, that which is asking questions about time is not time-driven. Quietness, stillness, which is a serious heart, a sincere heart, when we ask a question about something, when we know nothing about or suppose that we know anything about where this question will lead, we are very quiet in the generation of that question. When we ask, what is time, and we genuinely, truly don't know and have no formulated opinion, and we want to know, there's a yearning to understand, then everything gets very quiet. Now there's no thought, because if a thought comes in and starts anticipating what we're going to find, then we're not in the state of discovery, are we? So to stay in the state of discovery is to step out of time into the timeless. And so the only place that we can ask questions about time is from that state of discovery, which is, as I have mentioned on the X and Y axis that many of you are thoroughly disgusted with, it's to ask questions on that X and Y axis. You see, you have to be at the zero point. And there has to be this passion to know. This passion to know. It's interesting, I was reading in the Buddha's final sermon, his final discourse, he talks about being a lamp unto yourself. And then he talks about not setting up any authority. This is on his deathbed, right before he dies. His final words out of his mouth, right? Just be a lamp unto yourself. Don't set any authority up greater than your own authority. And then the final sentence before he dies, and you must be passionate to learn. You must have a deep passion to learn. So in other words, you can't be afraid of what this learning might, the result of this learning. We can't be afraid of where this learning will take us or what it will mean in terms of what our lives are in this moment. It's the wine glass. And if we're willing to throw the wine glass, then we're willing to go anywhere that this discovery will take us and the implications of that. And I have never in my decades of Dharma study ever been sorry that I went somewhere and looked at something. Never, not one time. And it may have been very startling what I saw, or maybe even very fearful prior to seeing it. But the implications never became adversive. Not even the slightest. You just take it, you readjust, and you move on. You just keep going. So this question of what is time? And as we get quiet, we begin to see that there's a lot of noise. When we sit down, when we make this inquiry, we see that there's a lot of noise in our minds. And our noise has to do with the description of things and the planning of things and the regretting of things and all of the different ways that we have locate ourselves on the axis in terms of what we have done or what we are going to do or who we are now and about ready to do. And all of that noise, it begins to be obvious, locates us somewhere. We feel located by the messages of the noise inwardly, the thinking, or the interpretation of external noise like birds and planes and all of that. All of that has a very exacting coordinate of self, it's like GDS systems or PGS or DLZs or what are they called? GPS. GPS systems. All that is a GPS system, internally guided GPS system for us. We know exactly where we are on the corner of 5th and Broadway or wherever. Or a different way of saying it is that we're 60 years old, male, you know, with this or that. All of it, doesn't it? Never lets you alone in that. So you begin to say, wait a second here. All of this noise is locating me. What or who am I outside of this location, this noise? If the noise is all locating me, that's fine, you know, but that's like a beacon on you. But who, what is it that's doing that? And it's thought or circumstances or descriptions that my mind is giving things, locating all of that. And I see myself in time being coordinated and finding my exact location. But now let me see, what am I? What am I if this noise subsides? Because this is all confusing. This just reinstates the obvious, right? I don't need all of that, do I? I don't think I do, to know who I am, to know what I am, to know where time has located me. I don't think so. I never have taken myself to be just that noise. But in order to see whether I'm more than the noise, I have to be quiet, even quieter. And as I get quieter, suddenly I get more vague. It's very interesting. We don't like vagueness. Suddenly I don't know, you know, exactly my coordinate anymore. I don't know where the lines cross to pinpoint who I am, because the thoughts aren't coming in to give me that particular location. It's not a beacon anymore. My thoughts aren't a beacon for my own sense of coordinates. And I get very fuzzy. Not in an anxious. As soon as I get anxious, I'm very located again, because that's the noise of the mind speaking back up about my anxiety about this fact, and then I'm very located. But if I don't get located, if I don't get anxious, if I just get quiet, I get vague. I'm not completely. It's not that I'm unknown. I'm just not known in the same way. Right? And there's something else that opens up. There's something else that's spacious, that has breadth. And If I'm willing, I can see that I'm perfectly fine, not me, but the organism is completely fine within this vagueness, within this lack of definition. There's nothing scary about it whatsoever. In fact, I can begin to, and I use the word I, but it's not from the sense of I that this is discovered. I get a sense that there is more to life than what I have been allowing the noise to define me as. In fact, in quiet, something else that has been abbreviated at best and obscured at worst from the noise begins to open up. And I get a sense, whoa! And suddenly I feel the value of life lived free of time. And the breadth of it. And the heart element of it. The heart, suddenly, see, as we press the heart within the barriers and boundaries of time limitation, it can't breathe and suffocates. It doesn't die, it's imprisoned. And as we allow ourselves to sit quietly, without definition, which is really what scares most of us. What does it mean? How can I live without definition? Well, you haven't tried. The fear of what you think will happen without definition keeps you defined. And so you won't ever challenge the fear to see what's on the other side of that fence post, and therefore you'll never be undefined. And so the fear is what keeps defining you and keeps you inhibited from testing the waters. Let us test the waters together here. Why would I tell you that it's safe if it's shark infested? I don't want to send anybody to their sudden death or to your madness. Insane. I'm not interested in seeing you insane. You'd just be more trouble for me. I'm interested in you being as sane as possible. Believe me. You see, so part of it is just, okay, look, it's safe. Now, come on. I remember early on, this is a transgression of enormous transgression, but anyway, I'll just say it. I remember early on reading this Swami, because I was into Hinduism 35 years ago. At one point, he had this huge congregation in front of him, and he says, anybody that would like to know the truth, come up here now, I will show it to them. And out of thousands of people in front of him, no one came up. And when I read that, I said, by God, I'd go. And this was like, you know, I was maybe a week into it. But I've always had that. And I think that there needs to be that passion to learn. We must have passion to learn. Must have passion to learn. So we say, what is time, you see? From this space, it becomes obvious. I've created it. It's self-created. And then I run after the message. And I keep myself bound within the message. I keep myself very tightly knotted within the concept, within the idea of time. But when I examine what that idea is, it falls apart, literally falls apart, because the mind that's quiet doesn't sustain time, because time can only be sustained through its noise. The problem is that most of us look to ask this question from a consciousness that's embedded within time, which means that we ask questions about time from the noise, or from fear, or from wanting to find out, or from all the different mental reactivity, which is time. And so time asks the question of time and never gets to any kind of resolution. It can't solve its own dilemma. Noise can't end itself. We have to ask this thing from a deeper part of us. All deep Dharma questions have to be asked. from that place. And then you see, who is the creator and what is time are really the same question. And when we get to this level of Dharma, all Dharma questions end here. All Dharma questions come into the same, end in the same place. But each of us quite likely has a gate that we can take to or through those questions which excite us and interest, which excite our passion to learn, which excite our curiosity to learn. Maybe death, so wait for the next series. But I'm hoping that it's time, is for some of you. It's time, and it's about time. So, the second way we can explore this, which is probably the way a kind of Bud Light approach. That's not a put down. It's just the way most of us do it, because the other way is too decimating. So most of us do it through the lighter channels. And again, that's fine. But it'll bring you to the same place if you do it with sincerity. So most of us want to explore the problems we have with time. So time is a given, and we want to know what the problems are we have with it. So what's the problem we have with it? You see, why? What is suffering is really the question that we enter this inquiry. What is suffering, and what does time have to do with suffering? We went through a whole talk about that, but just to encapsulate it real quickly, it has everything to do with suffering. We suffer through inference, right? Now, what do I mean by that? I mean suffering. First of all, let me back up for a second. People always tell me I don't finish my sentences, so I'm not going to finish this one. I'll come back to it. Buddhism sets nothing in opposition to itself. Nothing. Nothing. So if there's any opposition in your life, there's something that you are giving reality, imparting reality to, that's not real. So let's just cut to the chase. All right? I don't care if it's your next door neighbor, or I don't care if it's something inside of you that you dislike, or it can be physical, seemingly physical, it can be internal, or it can be conceptual. Doesn't matter. If there's an opposition, if you're opposed to something, if you feel a rub against something, the mind is creating an enemy. And there is no greater enemy than the enemy of time. Now, when we understand that, when we have created a problem out of something, again, remember, it can be conceptual, like time, and we make an enemy out of it, we're desperately in need, because our life depends upon not rubbing against everything. We limit ourselves, we make ourselves miserable through the rubbings of life. So let us look at the rubbings, where it is that we're rubbing against something. Now, we usually don't look at time as something that we can actually challenge. Rather, we look at what it is that time, the event, the circumstance, the boss that seems to be imparting a stressor on me that makes me hurry up and have no time to do the things I want to do. But we don't see it as about time. We see it as about whoever's on the other end of the request to speed us up, the pressure, the stress, the stressor, all of that. And so we blame it on the wrong thing. Since time is self-created, when we look at why we suffer, we're pressurizing ourselves. We're creating the tension internally through some kind of psychological dynamic we have with ourselves that needs to have people like us, so we put pressure on ourselves never to be late for something, or to always do the best job we can, or the perfect job, or something, all of that. That internal pressurizing, that stress, is time-driven, and time is conceptual. So we are creating the elements for our own misery. That's always true. But start blaming it where it needs to be blamed, on time. Okay, what is this thing? I mean, if any of you have ever picked apart your life or even one activity within life and separated it out from this time streaming that we go through every day, where all day long there's this continuous thing to do the next thing, this continuous need to get over what we're doing to do the next thing so that we can continue. It's all about continuance. It's all about movement. It's all about getting something done so I can what? So I can what? When does that what ever occur? When do we get it all done so that we can do what? We haven't even defined the what to know what we want to do. But we're doing it kind of like that. Like, let's finish this up. Like, let's get over this thing. But get over it to what? Because the continuation of this time streaming continues. Never subsides, never lets up. And we don't ask that same question. I don't know why we don't. Why don't we ask that same question? It's so sane to say, okay, where am I going? I mean, it's because we get a high, we get an endorphin high, I think, just for, in a sense of self-acclaim from the charge we get out of being needed or needing ourselves to do something and the rub and all of that. And the adversity of life and overcoming the adversity and the heroic endeavors I go through. You know, all of that nonsense. Let's look at this thing. So again, we have to get quiet. I'm afraid we can't do it from mind streaming. All it'll show you is that you need to keep doing it. It's only about continuance. Understand that. It's never going to let you off the hook. Does it let you off the hook? Ask yourself. Do you ever arrive? In fact, mind streaming is such is that there's nothing to arrive to because now is the only place we can arrive is obscured in a blur like a cartoon figure that runs across a vast canyon just kind of blurs it. So the now, which is only everything, but we will never mind. It's just a blur. It just keeps making a blur for the next place to put its foot. It never arrives. I mean, look at your jobs, you know. I mean, we set our jobs up. The consciousness of this culture sets our jobs up so that we'll run at a blur and never have enough time to arrive. How can I arrive? How can I be a good social worker, a good nurse, a good this or a good that? I don't have enough time. They're asking too much of me. Nonsense. Nonsense. Arrive all the time. Be unwilling not to arrive. Be unwilling to play the time streaming game. We create this culture so that we don't or cannot or have reasons, excuses not to arrive, not to show up for ourselves, not to show up for anyone else. Even when we're there, like a physician, like a therapist. It's all about the clock, isn't it? And in those rare moments when there's actually a meeting and that timeless exchange, that timeless presence holds the relationship, and therefore it's not about me and it's not about them, it's about that third thing that's formed in timelessness. Are very rare. Very rare. But we yearn for them. We call them intimacy. and we seek that's the best of our job. But more often, we bring such loaded consciousness to whatever it is that we're doing, even if it's a manual, fixing the car motor or whatever. And we never take it in. We never develop even a relationship with that. It's always about what we aren't doing or what we haven't done or what we did do that was so regretting. And therefore, when we're time streaming, time has to be seen as an object outside of ourselves. And we want more of it if it's going well. And we want less of it if it's not going well. If time is boring, we just as soon wish ourselves out of that. If it's hurting, if we're in pain or aversive, we just as soon. I wonder how much time we would actually live if you could actually wish yourself out of those situations that we really would like to just as soon pass over, and at the end of our life, how many years we would have actually lived. I don't know, but it wouldn't be very many, would it? And in boredom, we just let our mind determine the state of time. You see, boredom represents what's time, something about time. It's going too slow. It doesn't have enough excitement. Something is remiss in time. Pressure, stress. And as soon as we allow it to have a reality outside of the concept that we're creating, then it has power over us. It has absolute power over us and controls us. We give it power through giving it a sense of somethingness, and giving it an identity, giving it truth, validity when it has none. And then you see it sets up, when we have taken time to be real, then we're in spiritual crisis all the time. We not only have problems that are forever being created in all sorts of ways, because what we're doing is, when anything is in opposition to us, all we want to do is get over it and get through it, get around it, rather than to actually invite it, ingest it, integrate into it. And so then, spiritually, we come to the same problem. Like, you know, everything is set up to be problematic. Myself, ego, it's a problem. And now, I've got to get over this thing. All of that is the reason we want to get over it is because we have taken time to be true. You can't get over any. How can you get over anything now? Now, everything is met now, right? In the now, everything has to be met because it's only now. You've got to deal with it or that's it. But in time, it's all about getting over or through or around or bypass. And so all of those words that we use in our spiritual lingo just means that we have given ourselves over to the concept of time and given our spiritual lives away. Now is missed completely. It's like the question we ask young people, which is well-meaning, and we've all done it, so there's no blame in this. But what are we saying to somebody, 5-year-old, when we say, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because what we're really saying is that you only exist in what you will become, not what you are. You're only a little half-entity. if anything, and I have to put up with you until you get to be mature enough to be productive. That's... And I wish I could say that being elderly, it certainly does, in some cases, it can go two ways. It can make you more anxious and more... Or it can give you a sense of respite from a lot of time and a maturated view of time. But we're still in time. Let's not be too... And so in our spiritual lives, we go, okay, I've got to find the timeless. I've got to find the timeless. My quest, my spiritual quest, is to find the timeless. We're sitting in the middle of it. Could never leave it. Could never leave it. None of you have ever been anywhere but in the middle of the timeless. But because you're unwilling to give up time, you'll never see it. Or until you're willing to give up time, you'll never see it. We're facing the wrong direction. So if we're really sincere about finding the timeless or finding freedom or whatever it might mean, we just have to look at it from the right way, in the right way. We have to let go of what obscures it. See, there's a facsimile. The thing of it is, the mind is so incredibly clever, and the way it formulates its problem and then tries to get over the very problem it formulates. It's amazingly clever in this, in its disguise. And for years, we've searched for our own tail, running after it. Only just almost there. God, I really feel like I'm getting so close to the now. I just need another 3-month retreat. Instead of looking at the issue of what obscures the now, we run after more subtle fabrications of time, more clever disguises of the mind that keeps us from true contentment. When I say contentment beyond measure, that means contentment beyond time, because anything that is conditionally measurable is in time. I found contentment. I just have to remember exactly how I got here, which breath I was on, how I entered the... Okay, got it now. I can't wait until the next meditation and I'll get it back. That's not, you all have, if you continue in your practice, but we're running after it in the wrong way. The question is, are we sincere? Do we really want this thing? And I'm willing to play with you chasing your tail because I chased mine. So we all chasing our tails. We're willing to do that together. But let's, from time to time, sober up here. Let's admit what we're doing, that we really don't want this thing. It's too scary to us or too something. Because immediately, when we don't want it, it'll fall away. I'm afraid that's the fact. Because at some point we're refusing to play the mind's game of furthering time. We're not going to argue with time, because argument is just time opposing itself. I'm not going to try to get over anything. I'm not going to try to get through anything. I'm not even going to discuss anything with my mind, because it just would love to have a dialogue, because a dialogue confirms that it's not a monologue. And the last thing I want to do is to be alone in this. So I'll just continue a dialogue. I'll have my censor and my commentary and I'll be, but when we really want to get over it, we're willing to be absolutely alone. And we're going to give up. We start giving up the language we use, which is the language of evolution. Mostly, how we speak to ourselves in meditation is the language of evolution about evolving or progressing or doing well or it's a good meditation. All this qualitative language, which reasserts passages and time travel and journeying. And many teachers and textbooks and texts and literature and scriptural writings convince us that what we think about ourselves and how we think about our spiritual predicament and how we're working with it is all perfect. And there's no arrival. Never will be, never will be, until we're tired of time traveling. We're tired of all this, of growing old, dying, illness, and all the other ways that conditionality affects us. The Buddha's message was to go to how conditionality affects us until you're driven mad by conditionality. And then you say, is this it? Is there another way? And that's the first real sincere spiritual question that any of us could ask. And that's a spiritual question that will only take us to quiet. Can only take us to quiet. More important than anything, I want us to know the valid path. Whether we're willing to go and seek it isn't as important as not fooling ourselves that we're not seeking it. The honesty to say, you know, I'm just using meditation for a little bit of quiet. Relative quiet. We like to be in proximity of now. We like to approach arriving. We like to be in the proximity of the moment. And there's a little thought up here that we give and invest in. And that keeps us kind of, you know, sort of backed away, one step removed from total arrival. And so we sit with this little speaker up here who we call the watcher. And that keeps us feeling as if we are totally settled, but with just a minor irritant. Just a minor irritant that at some point I'm sure will go away, even though it hasn't in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. Until we say no more. And the heart's just waiting for that. So at least let's be on the path towards quieting. Let's understand that the meditation process, the spiritual journey, is not about adding more argument to ourselves. That's why self-allowance and self-acceptance is such a fundamental part, because the argument is released when we accept ourselves finally, and we aren't always in this kind of combative mood about who we are and what we are and how bad we've been. When we work through that, when we start marching our practice towards greater quietude and understand how the mind and its internal, eternal entrapment will constantly give rise to further argument, further discussion, another point to be solved, until we say, you know what? I'm not going there. And then we'll feel it. We'll come to that. and will end time. And when you do, even if you do it for an instant, you look out and you think, I can't believe that for eons this species has been so convinced that it's never asked, what is time and is it true? That it's been so locked up and keeping itself going that it won't ask that fundamental question that seems so obvious. Once we just step out of it for a moment, even if we go back in, which most of us do, you just can't believe it. That we could, 6 billion of us could be fooled every single moment of every single day for eons. That's what's truly wondrous. Okay, good, thank you all. Can we sit for just a minute or two? So as we sit, I like to give just kind of a guided, alignment to the talk. You see, now, the mind would love to be in opposition to the noise. It hears the noise and it says, okay, that's got to go. And therefore, we've made the noise a problem. And we've circled back in on the noise with a kind of irritation. So we can't do that, can we? It's got to be things as they are, without influence. So if the noise is there, it's there. If we want to know perfection, we have to see life free of our influence. And what's there is perfectly there. So add nothing to this moment. And that is stepping out of time. So that it's just this. Okay, so if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to do my best. It's okay. First, let me say to you all, you're not doing anything wrong, okay? Sometimes, because I like to sometimes challenge you, not sometimes, I like to challenge you about every time you come in here. But the point is that you can take that challenge as, oh my God, my practice, I'm just not doing, no, 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 you're all doing fine. You're all doing very well. You're all doing very well. But all of us, like any motor, needs to be fine-tuned, just needs to be hummed a little more, and for us to be grow in honesty to what we're doing to ourselves, and that we're perfectly comfortable doing whatever it is that we're doing, that we don't want to. And that's all. That's a very difficult, honest remark to make to oneself, is that because we set ourselves up as being, you know, if we don't really want the ideal, or that we just like to be comfortable for this particular time, then we feel like we've let ourselves down somehow. Nonsense. Nonsense. The honesty is all that I would request of you, and the honesty will clear out everything. Because when you're honest, you'll also see what you want, but you'll also see what you want isn't giving you. You'll see both sides of the equation. You'll see what you want. I just want to be comfortable. And you'll see what you want, being comfortable, isn't giving you. Well, it's, I'm not comfortable. Or I have to try too hard to get to it. Or it's conditional and only lasts a little while. So once you see that, and are honest with that, and you keep trying to be comfortable, eventually you'll wear yourself out because you won't be able to do it, not to the level that your heart wishes it from you. And so then you'll move on to the next obstruction, and we all have a lot of obstructions, a lot of desire in us to go in different ways. And that is a spiritual journey. And we can quicken the pace of the spiritual journey just by being absolutely honest with what we want and what isn't happening to make us completely satisfied within what we want. And we just continue to move right on through that. So it's not trying to get over what we want to get to some kind of ideal end. No, absolutely no noise, not adding, you know, that's, we have to figure out that that's the only way to live, truly live. But we think there's other ways to live, and we're going to play out the cards, the deck, until we have finished our strategies for those other ways to live, until then we will fall back in the wise way to live. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't make sense. It's the best I can do. Yes?
I get confused about how you can say, no, that's enough, I'm not going to do that anymore, and at the same time not be in opposition.
Right. So the question is, how you can say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore, and at the same time not be in opposition. It's a very good question. Because it's not saying, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. It's like, it's if you put your hand in the fire and you get burnt, and somebody says, will you put your hand back in the fire? You say, no. That's wisdom. It's, you may also have a little aversion to the fire. But inside, you just, no, I've tried that. And each of us, think of something that you've done in your life, a pattern that you've done. And at some point, you came to the end of that pattern and said, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. Now, every one of you probably can find some pattern in your life that you saw the end to. That is what it's like. That's what it's like. It's not an opposition. It's like, I see it's not working. I thought it was. That's why I kept trying it. Now I see it's not. And now I'm not going to try it anymore. You see? So the only way I can frame it in terms of speech is it sounds as if I'm putting us in opposition. But it's really wisdom, and it's a letting go, not an aversion. It's not a throwing away. It's just a release. No, it's just, in Buddhism, it's called discriminating wisdom. Yes?
I just want to reference something and give my question. There was recently two research institutions that did some research about
The question has to do with reaffirming a sense of self, and are there internal mechanisms for coordinating that sense of internal self on an ongoing basis? And that's really what I was trying to describe in terms of yes. One word, one single word locates you directly on the map of things. It doesn't matter what that word is. Any word connects all words in the vocabulary of things and connects you in terms of an identified response to that word. So it connects you as the... All it takes is one word to locate us in exactitude. Okay? So there aren't very many times when we aren't full of words. And even when we think, oh, now I'm quiet, this is interesting, then suddenly... I am now quiet. And we just keep adding words to whatever state we're in until you get tired of the location, of being located. And then you get quiet with the words so that the words, although they may come, do not reference anything. They only reference something when we're identified with the content of the word. But the word doesn't necessarily reference anything when it's just sound being heard. Okay? So As the mind gets quieter and stops referencing through language, through the commentator, through the watcher, through the, oh, I know what I'm doing, all of that sort of thing, and it comes out of meditation, there is a sense of not knowing oneself as well, kind of a vagueness. And you think, oh my God, I'm going crazy, which is usually the initial response, because we only know ourselves with a lot of words. We think, now I'm going crazy, so I've got to do something to get myself back grounded again. So usually that means doing something like turning on the radio or going to the refrigerator or doing something that gets us back into the normalcy of life where we are accustomed to our relationships to things and have a very definite sense of place within those relationships. But what I would suggest is just stay with the vagueness a little bit. When we come out of it and we're just a little bit quiet, it won't, maybe not absolutely quiet, just look around. Instead of trying to get yourself, oh, I'm crazy, and go to the fear response, invite a curiosity of vagueness. Don't worry, it won't stay very long. But as long as it does stay, it will show you the value and the benefit of being less defined. So that's step one. Right now, I'm not talking about people who psychologically, neurotically, or psychotically aren't defined or think they're somebody else or all that. I don't talk about, this is a completely sane mind I'm talking about, right? So I'm not suggesting people who are insane, you know, add this to their, right? So I don't know who I'm speaking to in all cases, and I'm just hoping all of you are taking this the way I mean it. Stabilized. You have to be stabilized in the sense of self before you can question your sense of self. And march it forward. Okay, now that's enough for tonight.